And get started. I want to welcome you all out to the tonight's Northern Regional Advisory Council meeting. I'm Robert Burns. We'll start with introductions. Jim?
I'm Jim Gaskill from South Weber, and still at large, but not for much longer.
Paul Cowley, I represent the Forest Service.
Craig Van Tassel from Camas, sportsman representative.
I'm John Blazard from Camas, representing agriculture.
John Leonard, North Ogden, represent sportsmen.
Lynn Nelson, Logan, representing elected officials.
Joel Ferry, Brigham City, representing agriculture.
Bryce Thurgood, Perry at large.
John Wall from Riverdale, public at large.
R. Jeffrey Hicks from South Weber, Utah, at large.
Kristen Purdy from Ogden, non-consumptive.
John Cabot from Hooper, non-consumptive.
And Justin Doling, regional supervisor with the Division of Wildlife, and I'm a serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
And again, I'm Robert Burns. I represent the public at large, and I'm the chair of the council. We don't have any wildlife board members here tonight. If you'd join me in turning off the ringers on your cell phones, we could have an uninterrupted meeting. The purpose of the Regional Advisory Council is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management policy, rules, and regulations. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board considers the recommendations from the five regional advisory councils and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. Please respect everyone's right to an opinion tonight, even if it's in conflict with yours, and we don't really need a lot of clapping or vocal outbursts to support other people's comments or to criticize them. This meeting will be recorded for the transcription of the minutes. The audio and those minutes will be available on the DWR website. When speaking, please use the microphones. There's one up there. The council members will be speaking into their individual microphones. If we can't pick you up very well, we'll try to give you a heads up. And the public will use the microphone there in the center. The division, when they're doing presentations, will use the microphone up here at the front. If speakers would state their name and where they're from when they first come up to state their questions or comments, it will help with our transcription. So the agenda that has been printed, Jody has put the WMA habitat management plans at the ends. That's a specific one for our region. So that's the only difference between what was sent out in the packet and what has been printed for the meeting. So the chair would entertain a motion to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting.
I'd move that we approve the agenda for tonight's meeting.
We have a motion from Paul Cowley and a second from Jim Gaskill to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Now, on the minutes of the April 7th meeting, I did have one spelling correction from Jim. Thank you for going through the minutes, Jim. It was phonetic, so of course, spell checker didn't get it, and I blew right over it, it looked like. So other than that spelling correction, are there any amendments to the minutes of April 7th? Seeing none, chair would entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So,
is there a second?
Second.
Okay. So we have a motion from John Wall and a second from John Leonard to approve the minutes of April 7th, 2015. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. I hope you had time to read my email I sent last night about the Wildlife Board's actions. There were quite a few extra motions in there changing permit numbers. And you saw that was mostly in reaction to the presence of people from the southern region and the impact that drought's having on them. So are there any questions about the Wildlife Board's actions? Jim.
Well, this is an age-old question of mine, and that is, did they give us any written reason for the changes in opposition to what we recommended?
I guess it's a fine line if their decisions were in opposition to our motions. They did change some permit numbers, but they didn't directly contradict any of our actions.
Well, clearly they did. If we recommended that they accept the division's presented recommendation and they did something else, that's clearly in opposition to our motion. The question is, and it's been brought up a million times by me, I've never felt like the Wildlife Board has lived up to their legal obligation to give us in writing a reason for not accepting recommendations or by changing recommendations. It seems to me like in this case, they're, at least from what I can determine, they're not doing what's in the best interest of wildlife. They're doing what's in the best interest of some livestock owners. And I love livestock owners, but that's not what the Wildlife Board's supposed to be doing. And so I'd like to hear how they justify that. And of course, this is something that's only, I know nothing's going to happen, but I feel obligated to put my 2 cents worth in, because the whole idea here is that we get together because the legislature has delegated to us the responsibility that they originally have for making laws. And the reason we've got these advisory councils is so that the people who didn't vote us in now have the opportunity to come and tell us what they want. And that's just, you know, that's democracy or the way the government's supposed to work. And I don't think that it's working very well. I think that there's special interests who don't even bother to come to the regional advisory councils and just go to the ones they like and know that we'll accept their ideas, and then the Wildlife Board does that, and they I think at least they ought to tell us why they're doing it.
Okay, so
I'll be quiet.
Their response would be, as it has been for several years, the written minutes of the Wildlife Board meeting would be the written response to any change or any vote against what you or what any individual regional advisory council had voted for. Now, I think every item that they did address was brought up by one of the 5 regional advisory councils. I don't think there was any unique item that a Wildlife Board member brought up that wasn't part of a regional advisory council motion, just from a different region. So
we'll call this a parting shot.
Yeah. Across the bow. Any other questions on the Wildlife Board's actions? Seeing none, we'll go to the regional update.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome everybody out to the Regional Advisory Council meeting. Just want to give a brief update of what's going on in our region. The wildlife section has been meeting with our habitat biologists to do spring range assessments, and essentially that's an exercise where they go out and look at the condition of the winter range and determine what kind of utilization it had over the course of the winter and what kind of condition it's in. And so that effort is currently underway, and Usually we put together a one-page summary of the findings on that. The biologists in the wildlife section are just completing up their spring deer classifications, and our sage-grouse lek counts and sharp-tailed lek counts have concluded this year, and it looks like sage-grouse are up again as far as attendance on the leks by males. And then in our wildlife section, the Ogden Bay Waterfowl Management Area will be interviewing for that position at towards the end of this month, and we should have a new manager in place hopefully by the end of May. So in our habitat section, our habitat section is essentially, it's kind of a winding down period where they're putting the final touches on projects and then also gearing up for projects that were approved through the WRI process. And the watershed, WRI stands for the Watershed Restoration Initiative. And so they wanted me to indicate to you all that we are going through a database update. And so there'll be a new database for the Watershed Restoration Initiative. And so the federal agencies and some of the private folks that make proposals to that database, they'll see a little different look come next November and December. And then to replace Ron Greer, who recently passed away, we will be having our interviews the end of this week, and that'll be for our regional terrestrial restoration biologist. Then our administrative service section wanted to just remind everybody that turkey permits, over-the-counter turkey permits, are now available. So if you have an interest in going out and hunting a turkey, now's the time to go in and get your permit and go out and get her done. May 29th will be the posting for the results of the Bucks, Bulls, and Once-in-a-Lifetime drawing. And if you look probably a week prior to that, you might see there could be a hit on your credit card, which is kind of a precursor to a successful application. Our antlerless application period starts May 28th and will run through June 19th. Either June 19th or June 18th. I've got both of them down. And the results of that antlerless draw will be posted and available the 9th of July. In our aquatic section, we just finished up stocking a little over 20,000 tiger muskies in Pine View Reservoir. A pretty good portion of those came from our own hatchery. We finally perfected the way to raise tiger muskies, and so that's kind of good news. It's an effort that we've been trying to accomplish for several years now, and have finally kind of bridged over and have been able to successfully raise young tiger muskies. And they also wanted to report that fishing right now at Wheeler Bay is extremely, extremely good. The crappie are running between 12 and 14 inches, and the wipers and the walleyes are really biting hard. So if you like to fish out at Wheeler, it'd be a good time to get out there and get her done. In our outreach section, our YouTube channel has now exceeded over 1 million views, and that includes all our YouTube videos that go out on our website and our Facebook site. Quite popular with the wildlife enthusiasts here in the state. And the other thing they wanted me to mention is that we do have a regional Facebook page now, Northern Region Wildlife Facebook page. So if you're a Facebooker and want to join that page, it gives you some little updates on what's going on in the region and really provides a good look at how fishing is across the regional boundaries. The other thing they wanted me to mention is we have an effort called Wild Find, and it's a media effort where we try to get information out to the media about upcoming activities that are occurring in our region. And it's kind of a little teaser for the media to come out and do a follow-up story, and those are extremely popular. Everybody's interested in what's going on in the wildlife world, and it's a way we can engage the media. And I just wanted to know by a show of hands, how many RAC members get an invite to the Wild Find list? Are you guys all on that mailing list? Okay, great. And feel like you can come out and participate as well, so keep that in mind. In our law enforcement section, we did have a pretty good saturation patrol out at Willard towards the end of April, given the fishing conditions out there. So essentially a saturation patrols where we dedicate several officers to go out, and some of which are under undercover, go out and kind of observe what's going on and do a concerted effort all in one area. So that occurred towards the end of April. And then lastly, we have 6 members that will be leaving us on the RAC. This will be their last and final RAC meeting. I wanted to take a moment and just express the appreciation of the Division of Wildlife for members who have served on the RAC. It's quite a time commitment. Not only are some of our meetings extremely long, I know some of them can go 5 to 6 hours, but in addition to that, it requires a lot of prep time, time away from your family, and time away from your personal priorities. So I want to just thank all the outgoing RAC members for their service, and I hope you realize that your service does make wildlife and wildlife enthusiasts here in the state, it produces a much better product than without the RAC. The RAC is valuable from the standpoint it brings a group of collective minds that have somewhat similar and diverging interests, and hopefully that generates good decisions in the end. So thanks for your effort, and at the end of this meeting, we've got a Bronson print we'd like to present each one of the RAC members, so please stick around for your Bronson print. And I just want to go through and acknowledge those members that will be leaving the RAC tonight. Robert Burns, our chair. He's been our chair for a long, long time now. What, 6 years? 4 years. 4 years. Paul Calley with the Forest Service. Paul's been here for 2 terms, which is, what, eight years? 6 years. 6 years. Eight. Okay. Jim Gaskell, at large. He's been with us for 2 terms. We'll miss Jim. He always makes these meetings real lively. And then our Jeffrey Hicks has served 1 term here on the RAC, and so he'll be going off this evening as well. And then John Leonard has served 2 terms, correct, John?
Right.
And he represents sportsmen, so he'll be going off as well. And then Lynn Nielsen, our elected official, has served 1 term, and he'll be going off as well. So thank you all again for your efforts. I hope you go do something good for wildlife, and look for some other opportunities to promote and preserve what I feel is a real critical and wonderful heritage we have here in the state. So thanks again, and I'll turn the time back over to the RAC chair unless there's any questions. Go ahead, Jeff.
It's not a question, it's a comment.
Comment, okay.
On that wild find and the YouTube and the Facebook and all the other media outreach that's been going on the last couple of years, I think through Mark Hadley's been doing those things. I just think that's been great. And, the suggested articles out to the media, I'm starting to see them in even the Tribune and the Standard Examiner. I think it's been a great thing. So, God, I can't say enough about what a great outreach that's been. I think it's been real successful. So there's my 2 cents. There's my parting shot.
Okay, I'll pass that thank you along to Mark. I know he works hard on trying to get that information out.
What's the Facebook name?
I believe it's Northern Utah Wildlife.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. So I'll just go over our operating procedure for the rest of the meeting. A representative from the Division of Wildlife Resources will make a presentation on the agenda item. Then we'll have questions from the public on the presentation. This time is for questions only, not comments. Next, we'll have questions from the council on the presentation. Then we'll take comments from the public on the agenda item. Persons representing themselves will have 3 minutes to comment. Persons representing organized groups will have 5 minutes to comment. Please fill out a blue card. They're available on the table back in the back of the room. Then we'll know who to call up, and it also helps with our transcription of the minutes. Often I say your name incorrectly, and we don't need to have that proceed forever forward. So at the end of the public comment period, The public portion of that agenda item ends, and further public participation will only be at the request of a council member for clarification. Next, the council will comment on the agenda item. Then the council will make motions recommending action by the Wildlife Board on the agenda item, deliberate those motions, and vote. Council members who wish to abstain from voting will state their conflict, and council members voting in opposition to a motion will provide their reasoning if they wish. Then we'll proceed on to the next agenda item. So now we will go to the waterfowl recommendations.
There we go. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Blair Stringham. I'm the Migratory Game Bird Coordinator, and tonight I'll be presenting the 2015-2016 waterfowl hunt recommendations. So to start off, I want to just give a brief update real quick about the timelines we've been working on the last few years with the Fish and Wildlife Service. Currently, the way we've been operating is we meet as a flyway, the Pacific Flyway, usually around July. We'll go through and formulate our recommendations, which we submit to the Fish and Wildlife Service. After they approve those, it goes on to a state selection process where we select the recommendations that we want for our hunting season for that year. Then they go on and they're published in the Federal Register, usually sometime about the middle of September. The problem with this time frame is that it pushes the recommendation period right up to almost the start of the hunts. And if we don't have those in place before the hunt dates begin, we can't officially have a waterfowl season. So we've worked with the Fish and Wildlife Service for the last few years, come up with a schedule that will give us ample time to prepare our recommendations as well as have those published in the Federal Register long before the hunts begin. So the way we'll be operating essentially for the 2016-17 season forward is that we'll start our flyway process in September. The recommendations from the flyways will be approved by the Fish and Wildlife Service in the October timeframe. And that will allow us to do our waterfowl recommendations a lot earlier than we have in the past. And we're tentatively aiming for the December RAC meeting. So that would mean this coming year, in December, we'll be doing the 2016-27 hunting recommendations. That'll give us several months to have those published in the federal frameworks, and then long before our hunt begins. It'll give waterfowl hunters an opportunity to know when the hunts will begin in advance so they can prepare for time off and things like that. And so overall, it should be a pretty good change. But for this RAC meeting, we'll be doing the 2015-16 recommendations, and currently those haven't been accepted by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so what I'll be presenting tonight are essentially what we anticipate the Fish and Wildlife Service accepting. But do keep in mind that there is a possibility that those could change, and if it does, we will just go with the maximum opportunity the Fish and Wildlife Service provides for us. I wanted to give also just a few updates on hunter numbers and waterfowl numbers. Really, we've been tracking hunter numbers since about the mid-1940s, and overall, those have kind of tracked really well with our waterfowl populations, which have fluctuated through time. Really, up to about the year, about 2000 or so, we saw a decreased drop in the number of waterfowl hunters that we had across the state. And that really hasn't rebounded or kept up with waterfowl populations, which really have increased dramatically since that time forward. Possible reason for this, we really don't know, but it has given more direction to our waterfowl program to try to increase our outreach effort. Justin talked about several of these, that we've tried to increase our media response, have more information out there for the public, and we've tried to provide workshops as well as increase access in the form of infrastructure, as well as through our walk-in access program and several initiatives like that. We've also worked to try to increase our resources we provide for hunters, such as maps, online tutorials, and so you may see more of this in the future. And it's really an attempt to increase our waterfowl hunter numbers, because given the number of waterfowl we have now, we've never had more in the state, and so now's a great time to become a waterfowl hunter or continue the waterfowl hunting tradition. The last update I have is for the duck stamp increase. Many of you may have heard of this, or maybe you haven't. This will go into effect for the 2015-16 season. This is a program that was started many years ago by the Fish and Wildlife Service in an attempt to increase waterfowl habitat across the continent. 98% of all the money that's ever been raised through this program has gone directly back to habitat acquisitions as well as habitat easements. To date, it's raised about $800 million, which has conserved roughly 6 million acres across the continent. Much of this usually goes back into the Prairie Powell region, but it has produced many, many ducks, and so it has been a great program that way. The last increase for the duck stand was in 1991. At that time, it was estimated that waterfowl habitat would cost about $306 an acre to conserve. Today, that's increased about $1,100. So really, the buying power of the duck stamp has decreased quite a bit since the last increase. And so for that reason, Congress voted this last year to increase the waterfowl stamp from $15 to $25. And so that will go into effect on July 1 of this year. Moving on to some of our population data. As I mentioned a minute ago, duck production across the continent has been terrific. This last year, in 2014, we had a record of about 50 million ducks, and we would anticipate that's probably going to be the same this year. Biologists are currently collecting that data, and it should be available to us probably around the end of June. But we anticipate a really great fall flight this next year. Canada goose numbers, similar trend. They've really been trending upward for many, many years now and continue to look great across our flyway. Swan numbers, same story as well, continuing to slowly trend upward, and we have a really strong swan population as well. So the way our hunt packages are given to us each year, it's based largely on what our population of mallards are doing in this part of the flyway. Given the fall flight last year, we anticipate to have another liberal season this year, which would be 107 days and a bag of seven. And we do have several species that are under species-specific management plans. That's pintail, canvasback, and scop. For those, we would anticipate season dates and bag limits being essentially what they were last year, with 107-day season per pintail and the maximum bag of two that's currently offered under that harvest strategy. Canvasbacks will likely be 107 days as well, with the bag of one or two, depending on what that population does this spring. And scop would probably be similar to what it was last year with an 86-day season and bag of three. We're proposing the waterfowl season this year to begin on October 3rd and run through January 16th. If the scop season is 86 days, it'll be from October 3rd till the 27th of December. We really don't anticipate much changes in the bag limits from last year, but if those do occur, we'll go with whatever maximum is offered by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And for coot, snipe, and falconry, those shouldn't change. They should be the same as they were last season. For our northern goose zones, we're not proposing any recommendation changes here as well. We'll continue with the northern goose zone, as well as the urban and rest, which have the two different separations or blocks of time that those close to maximize hunting opportunities towards the end of the season. The bag and possession limits will be the same. For our light goose season, we aren't recommending any changes in the northern zone. We are recommending extending that date 1 week later in the urban and rest of the state zone. We're starting to see a lot of light geese coming north earlier and earlier in the winter. We are having quite a few starting to show about the first part of February. So we're recommending in the southern and central part of the state that date be extended until February 7th. This will allow for some hunting opportunity as those birds begin to move north, and then we'll close it for a few weeks to accommodate the Snow Goose Festival in Delta and reopen it on March 1st through the 10th. For swan season, these dates aren't changing either. The hunt area will be the Great Salt Lake boundary, as it always is, with 2,000 permits offered. The youth day will be on September 19th, which is approximately 2 weeks before the general waterfowl hunt opens. And this year, again, we're going to go with a half hour before sunrise start for the whole season. We implemented this last year and didn't have any problems with shooting or anything like that, so we feel comfortable with going forward with that in the future. One change for our migratory upland birds, the upland guidebook is on a three-year rotation, so we try not to make any changes unless we absolutely have to. This year for band-tailed pigeons, the harvest strategy that we worked out with the Fish and Wildlife Service does require us to reduce that season from 30 days to 14 days. And so we'll be reducing that hunt from September 1st to the 14th, and everything else during that hunt will be the same other than those dates. And then lastly, just a few changes we're making to the waterfowl rule. We are finally getting around to updating the name from common snipe to Wilson snipe. It changed quite a few years ago, and so we're making that change. We also went through and clarified the difference between our rest areas and essentially are closed or are non-shooting areas. One of the controversies we had this last year was with Antelope Island Causeway. There was some controversy over what activities could occur along the causeway within that 600-foot buffer. And we've redefined that to be pretty much everything other than actually hunting within that boundary. So hunters are allowed to retrieve birds within that boundary, drive boats through there, walk, bird, whatever you'd like. You're just not allowed to shoot into that buffer or shoot while you're in that buffer. We also redefined the boundaries around the airport and Great Salt Lake harbors to make those clearer, and also clarified the rest area boundaries on our WMAs to make those less ambiguous. And then lastly, we had one update we need to make regarding our blind situation. We do generally allow people to have blinds on our WMAs, but there are some limitations to those. We also allow people to have a few less of those restrictions if they're between our outside impoundments and the Great Salt Lake boundary. And this specifically refers to Farrington Bay and the Doug Miller unit. Previously, before 2008, the outside boundary was the Crystal unit. And in 2008, we created this Doug Miller unit, which essentially has now become the outside boundary for between Farrington Bay impoundments and the Great Salt Lake. And so it sounds technical, but it's really just a simple modification we needed to make. So, and those are my recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you, Blair. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? If you do, please come up to the microphone and no.
My question is, what brought forth the northern goose zone split out of the rest of the state?
It's something that we did quite a few years ago. There was some opposition to us having the split in the eastern part of Box Elder County. And so through the RAC and board process, we established the northern zone, which largely encompassed a lot of the clubs out to the west of us, which were in opposition to having the split during the season.
I represent one of them clubs out there, and we'd like to see that.
Do you have a question? And can I get your name?
Kenny Gibbons.
Kenny, okay.
Yeah.
Do you have an additional question?
Or? Yeah, what will it take to be able to put that back in as a statewide managed hunting zone with the rest of the state?
It's currently not one of our recommendations for this year. I guess I could speak to, the biological aspect of it. The reason why they were created is just to provide more hunting opportunity. From a biological aspect, it really doesn't affect our goose populations at all. Typically, what we've seen for our banding data is that the hunter harvest occurs mostly in the first 2 weeks of October and then towards the end of January. And so, I guess from a biological perspective, it probably wouldn't matter either way for us. It would just depend on what the RACs and boards wanted to do as far as a recommendation.
So if you see the greater harvest towards the end of January, wouldn't it make sense to extend that and have it statewide and easier managed that way?
It probably would simplify recommendations a bit. From a biological perspective, it probably won't affect goose populations really one way or the other. So.
Okay, thank you.
Ken Dillery from Corinne, Utah. Blair, I talked with you a little bit about this northern goose zone. So right now it's questions, and then if I understand right, you can comment for a group afterwards. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. I guess one of my questions is, have you been approached about this northern goose zone by other than just my group that's here tonight in years past? Has it been an issue at all?
I've been doing this for about 3 years now, and this is the first time it's ever come up.
Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and save my comment for, I guess when the comment phase comes up. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to questions from the council. Jim?
So, could you go back to that first slide?
Sure.
The first graph, that one, yeah, right there. So that doesn't necessarily represent the trend in Utah waterfowl. That's national North American waterfowl population, correct?
Yeah, so the black line is the duck population across North America.
Right.
And then the blue line represents waterfowl hunters in Utah.
Do you have any kind of numbers for Utah waterfowl?
We have some numbers, but largely, you know, our populations, our breeding population is probably going to be, you know, upwards of maybe 100,000 ducks. And so overall, on the continent scale, when they're producing 50 million ducks, majority of those are coming from Canada, Northern Prairies, and Alaska. So overall, we're not a huge waterfowl producer here in the state, but we do provide an important staging area for birds as they move south in the fall and back north in the spring.
Yes. What I'm trying to understand is, and I think I understand it pretty well, but why we're experiencing a fairly significant decrease in the Utah waterfowl hunting population. And is it not true that the bulk of our, at least our Canada geese, and probably our ducks, are local ducks and geese, not necessarily flyway? We're not in the middle of a flyway. We're on the fringe, right?
Really, the Great Salt Lake is probably one of the major staging areas across the Pacific Flyway. So we'll get birds that will come from the central part of the continent all the way across over to Alaska and British Columbia. And a lot of them will funnel right down through Utah. And so we are really a significant player here in the flyway.
Have we done any goose banding studies lately?
Yeah, we annually band geese, and we've been doing it for probably 30 plus years.
Yeah, and is it not correct that the vast majority of the bands we get are Utah geese?
Yeah, and part of that is because we are probably the biggest player in banding geese. We typically band like 3,000 to 5,000 geese here in our flyway, and here in our state, I mean. And across the flyway, there's maybe 1,000 more geese that are banded. Geese banding really hasn't been a big priority, particularly for the bigger Canada geese we have here. A lot of the smaller Canada geese on the West Coast, like the cacklers, have been banded a lot more, but we rarely get those here. So
what do you think is the reason for the great decrease in hunting popularity in Utah?
Right. Nationally, there has been a decline in the number of hunters. Specifically here for Utah, for waterfowl hunters, I really don't know for sure. It kind of coincides with that 2000 time frame. Maybe it's Facebook. Who knows?
You don't think it has to do with the lack of hunting opportunities and the lack of birds? For example, in my early days, we expected a million ducks at Bear River Bird Refuge every fall.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're getting a million ducks there.
I mean, really.
At any given time, a million ducks. Not just a peak, but from early September on up into at least midway through October.
You know, it's hard to say exactly what's happened. I mean, we still have a lot of birds, and there were times last year on the Bear River Bay, west of Bear River Bird Refuge, where there were probably about 500,000 green-winged teal last year. And that was just, you know, an area where probably hunters weren't seeing them at all because they were on the west side of the lake along Promontory Point. And that was not taken into account probably hundreds of thousands that were along the eastern shores, too, that hunters were actively hunting every day. So overall, I mean, there's probably periods of time here in Utah where we have over a million ducks just on the Great Salt Lake still. I don't know if it's a perception issue or maybe they're just not as accessible to hunters. It's hard to say, but there are still a lot of birds that move through Utah each fall and spring.
John?
Blair, I was wondering, have you guys conducted any kind of hunter satisfaction surveys recently, and what are they telling us?
Yeah, we did a hunter satisfaction survey about 2 years ago, and largely people were really satisfied with the waterfowl hunting in Utah. Typically, I think our average was around 3.5 to 4 on a scale of 5 for hunter satisfaction. So we did create a Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Management Plan several years ago and addressed if it fell below, you know, a certain point, we would start looking at ways to increase hunter satisfaction. But overall hunter satisfaction has really remained high. It's just the number of hunters that have dropped off. So.
Jeffrey.
A couple questions about that goose zone, trying to help kind of clarify it for these guys also. So if two things. One is if they were to get rid of that north zone as they're asking for, would that mean that the late goose season that we've been experiencing, the extended days, would be okay in that area also?
Yeah, I mean, what would probably make the most sense is just, if we did away with that, it would just fall into the rest of the state. So it essentially have two zones, the urban zone and the rest of the state zone.
And one more question. So if these gentlemen would like to make a recommendation to have the regulations changed, I know there's a certain time to do that. What meeting do they need to be at to do that? Is this the one where they say we want to make a recommendation to the Wildlife Board to change these regulations?
Yeah, if any of these changes happen, it would happen at the RAC and board meetings.
When you said that you're on a three-year rotation on the regulation, that's just a publication, right?
Yeah, and that's specifically for the Upland Game Guidebook. Yeah. The waterfowl recommendations we've been doing annually.
Okay.
And so whatever essentially is approved at the board meeting is what we'll go forward with our recommendations to the Fish and Wildlife Service in July. So if that change, if that's something that you guys wanted to make tonight, then that's probably the time to do it. So.
Okay. And just to reiterate, you said there isn't any real reason that you can see except there's been some of the clubs had wished that it was a different zone so they could close earlier. Is that what it is?
Yeah, in the past it's largely just been a social situation, and so we've always just kind of addressed the biological implications for stuff like that. And the harsh pressure on geese has been significant the last couple of years, and we haven't seen any negative impacts on geese. So.
Okay, thanks.
Any additional questions from the council?
Robert.
Oh, Joel.
I have a question on migratory birds. The sandhill crane, I didn't see anything on that. Do you anticipate the same number of tags for the state this year?
Our allocation did go up this last year. I believe it went up to about 100.
Ooh.
And so we haven't done the permit process yet, but Box Hill County will be getting
Keep Box Hill County in mind when you do that.
We will.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been going off of an allocation, just giving percentages to each one of the four areas. So Box Hill will definitely be going up this year.
Everyone's going to go up.
Yeah, everybody will be going up.
Yeah. Good. Good deal. Thank you.
Any additional questions? John.
On the federal duck stamp, I know you don't have to fill out no information who buys them, but do you know if there's any federal groups or organizations that tracks maybe or surveys who buys those duck stamps?
I couldn't tell you that data off the top of my head. I know it's largely bought by hunters just because it's required to hunt, but there are quite a few different user groups that will buy them, like non-consumptive users. Some refuges, really push those, and a lot of non-consumptive users will buy those just to access refuges and things like that. So.
Jeffrey.
Sorry, one more follow-up on that northern zone. Now they got me thinking. So if they were to extend that season out to join the rest of the northern zone or the urban zone or whatever you want to call it nowadays, would the Bear River Bird Refuge, because it's federal, would they be obligated to follow along the same dates?
Typically, they have supported whatever our waterfowl recommendations are. It would be up to them if they were to open their gates for that or not. And I haven't spoke with them one way or the other.
So they could opt out, though?
It is potentially, yeah, that they could.
Okay. Mm.
Any additional questions? John?
You see no reason, though, that, I guess, what was the original reason for having that separated from the urban zone?
It was mostly just based off of social pressure. Several of the clubs out west here in Corinne were opposed to having the split, and so out of that just came the northern zone.
Freeze up or?
Yeah.
Freeze up on
the. John?
Yeah.
She's not getting you on the mic. Could you grab that?
Okay. The concern was over freeze-up during that period that you...
Not necessarily. I think they just wanted to have a continuous season from the opening of the waterfowl hunt and have it run straight through till the last possible day. And so because of that, it can run 106 days. So it went from essentially this year, go from October 3rd till January 16th. Where if you look at like the rest of the state zone, there's a break from the 15th to the 24th. And so they just didn't want to have a break in their season like that. So.
Okay, we'll go to comment cards. Becky Wood.
Okay, I made it to the mic. Okay, thank you. My name is Becky Wood. I'm a Huntsville resident. That's in Ogden Valley, that newspaper.
Becky, step up to the mic a little closer, please. Thank you.
Sorry.
There you go.
Okay, Becky Wood. I live in Huntsville. I'm from Ogden, which is in Ogden Valley. I am requesting a restriction on, well, hunting and trapping, but Justin told me I could only talk about hunting tonight. I brought a picture of the area, part of the area in Ogden Valley, so you can take a look at that. And not just note its incredible beauty, but I want you to note that I'm standing in my own backyard when I'm taking this picture. So any hunting activities that are going on are easily heard, easily seen by residents. Those the flight paper you have that has a list of names on it, that was generated from an article I wrote in our local newspaper after attending one of these meetings and the DWR meeting in Salt Lake, when I was asked, who else feels this way? Is it just you? And so I wrote an article asking people to get in touch with me. It included my email and my phone number, if they were like-minded people, and if they also would like to see this restricted. There's no buffer zone in this area that I'm aware of. People can come right into these areas and hunt and trap very close to our homes, within sight, within sound of our private residences. It isn't like I got an overwhelming response, truly I didn't, but the stories I heard made a big impact on me. And one of those stories was from an older woman who loves looking out her backyard and her back window at the geese who come there. There's lots of streams in this area and two major rivers, and it becomes Pine View Reservoir during the summer. This area fills up with water, it's a natural basin, and people use it for boating activities during the summer. She gave me, well, anyway, one of the older women responding gave me a very graphic description of an incident where people came right in back of her home and killed some geese, and how upsetting that was for her, and how she tried to find help thinking surely this had to be wrong, and it was told that it wasn't wrong, that this was legal, and it was... Yeah, and as long as they were obeying hunting laws, they weren't doing anything wrong. I would ask that this committee consider the reason of sensitivity as a valid reason to restrict hunting in our area. And along with, well, safety, but these people were obeying safety laws with their guns. Anyway, that is... I hope I haven't left anything out. That's the main thing I came to say. And thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Becky. Stephen Clark.
Can we ask a question?
Becky, we have a question for you. If you would,
I'm wondering, Becky, if you could mention what the land ownership is surrounding your house or residence, so that we have an understanding of where.
Huntsville is an organized community. I have neighbors on either side of me. Within the city limits of Huntsville, it's illegal to discharge a firearm. And yet, this is as close to me as any of my neighbors would be, and it's legal here. There's a house over here, there's a house over here. The Huntsville proper sits up on a bluff, and the Pine View Reservoir surrounds Huntsville. It's an incredible, beautifully place to live, just incredible. But the town of Huntsville contains about 500 residents, and within the city limits of Huntsville, discharging a gun is illegal. But right here, right next door to us, it's not.
So Becky, that property that's outside of Huntsville is Forest Service property, is that
right.
correct?
Right. This is this is the picture. I'm standing on my back lawn, but I'm facing the Forest Service property. And that's what this picture here.
All right.
Or should I wait till the end?
If it's
That's Pine View Reservoir. The other thing I wanted to mention.
Well, we just need to.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Focus on the questions. So,
all right.
Your neighbors are private property except for Pine View, which is Forest Service, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, Jeffrey, you have a question for us?
Yeah, I had a question, but maybe for Paul. Is all the land on and surrounding the high water mark, is that all administered by the Forest Service, or is that state sovereign land also?
That's administered by the Forest Service. So originally, when they built Pine View Dam, Bureau of Rec, is my understanding, they built that. And then it's pretty typical that they'll turn over that bathtub ring to another agency, similar to Strawberry or Pine View in this case, where there's that margin from low to high water, and then a little bit above that that's been kicked to the Forest Service. And Becky's correct in that they're, you know, if you look at Pine View and the way it surrounds Huntsville, it probably surrounds the western half of Huntsville, along with the number of recreation facilities we have out there on the reservoir.
Thank you, Becky.
You're welcome.
Stephen?
Good evening. I would also support that recommendation of Becky's. Seems that there's a change that has taken place up there. All of the hunting that would take place on Pine View would be on the western side where all of the developments or the houses are.
You're fine.
And so it seems to me that it's a question of numbers. There are probably very few hunters out there that hunt, yet there's an awful lot of people who live there or who recreate there who are impacted by their hunting. So I would suggest that you consider at least the possibility of setting that area around the edges of Pine View Reservoir as a no-hunt zone for waterfowl, and even extend it because of the recreational use and all of the other kind of interest in the area that isn't involved hunting, to consider the possibility of making it a wildlife preserve on the edges of the reservoir. That would be my suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you. Carol Campbell.
My name is Carol Campbell. I also live in Huntsville. And
Carol, can you pull that mic down to you a little bit? There we go. Thank you.
I also live in Huntsville. And judging by the comment about the Antelope Island Causeway, I think we're probably facing a similar issue, where that area around Pine View used to be fairly rural and not that heavily trafficked. Now that's not the case. There are a lot of homes, there are a lot of recreational users, bikers, hikers, and so forth. And I think that while I don't have anything against hunting wild waterfowl or anything else, in that area, I certainly wouldn't suggest that you'd want to hunt waterfowl at the Weber State Pond. And sometimes I feel like we're about that inhabited with people around Pine View. So I would ask for your consideration on restricting that area. Thank you.
Thank you. Ken Dillery. Is that correct, Ken?
Dillery, yes.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, I would just like to start. I sent a letter to the RAC board members, and I'm not just commenting, you know, for me and a bunch of my buddies. I talk to a lot of hunters. That's what I do for a living, as I run a commercial pheasant hunting preserve. So I see lots of people from the public side, the club side, and so this is coming from a lot of people that do have clubs in Box Elder County in that area. And if it's okay, I'll just go ahead and read a real short excerpt from what I said. We as sportsmen that are avid goose hunters would really like to see what is now called the Northern Goose Area hunting season removed from the proclamation. We instead would like to see Northern Utah or Box Elder County all be classified under what is called the General Goose Area. During the 2014-2015 waterfowl season, the Northern Goose Area season ran from October 4th, 2014 to January 17th, 2015. The General Goose Area season ran from October 4th to 16th, 2014 and October 25th, 2014 to January 25th, 2015. Basically closing the goose hunting from October 17th through the 24th, which extended the General Goose Area hunting season to January the 25th. From the Division of Wildlife side of the fence, it simplifies the waterfowl proclamation if you make the whole state a general goose area. From the sportsman's side, it gives us more hunting days and better hunting opportunities in January to hunt geese when our local population of birds increases as they return to the area. The past several years, hunting in late December and January has been very exciting and productive for northern Utah goose hunting, and we have lamented the fact the season closes earlier than the southern part of the state. With the recent increase in bag limit to four dark geese a day and the fact that our local Canada goose population throughout the state is in good condition, it just makes good sense to allow all goose hunters statewide to have the same hunting opportunities to harvest these birds. One other thing I'd like to comment on, and I talked with Blair about, as far as the split season in the general goose zone, I believe they close it for the last 2 weeks in October. With what the Division of Wildlife has done in the last several years as far as releasing pheasants in the state of Utah and trying to get the sportsman's interest again in pheasant hunting like it was years ago, the first 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, you've got your pheasant hunters out that are beating the bush in the fields and around the marshes. And if any of you that have hunted ducks and geese know, that doesn't bode well for setting decoys and hunting geese in the fields. Maybe something to look at would be closing, if we do the split season, the first 2 weeks in November, when essentially that area, that time period, as I've described, is kind of thrown out the window, and basically make better use of our time as far as hunting is concerned. But anyway, that's the comment I had, and I appreciate your time and your courtesy. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for him.
Yes.
Just for clarification, are you suggesting that you'd like to do away with the urban zone and the northern zone so that you just have the whole state the same? Is that your recommendation?
No, sir. I'm just speaking on the northern zone only. We'd like to combine that with the general goose zone for the whole state so that there's no line or classification for the northern zone.
Okay, but there still would be the urban zone.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Carl Settler.
Carl Settler with the Bear River Club. I think that changing the northern goose zone right now would not be wise. Like Mr. Dillery said, the goose hunting has been fabulous the last 2 years late. The reason for that is Pacific Corp draining Cutler Reservoir, giving the birds a roosting spot, mud. Also, the club property in Elwood, we did a two-year drain and repair of the dam there also, which left open water all year long for the birds to roost, to use the cornfields. And then the third project we did was out repairing all the main spillway that dumps our lake into Unit 1 of the refuge, which left a huge spot for the birds to... And we were basically holding all the birds in northern Utah. All those projects are completed. So what's going to happen is it's going to be 10 years again before somebody starts working on dams. So in other words, it's going to freeze up tight, and there'll only be 10% of the geese left by the January 16th. The birds will be gone. So I recommend you leave it just the way it is, because, like you said, the last 2 years it's been good. That's just because we've had water for them. Normally it's frozen tight.
Thank you. That's all the blue cards I have on this agenda item. Is there anyone else from the public who'd wish to comment? Seeing none, we'll go to the council then. Comments from the council. I'd especially be interested in some comments, if you have them, of you specific duck and goose hunters. So, Jeffrey.
This is comment period, so I'll do mostly comments, but I might have a little bit of a clarification, so keep that in mind. So, as I see it, as a waterfowl hunter, and I know a lot of people that do waterfowl hunt, there just doesn't seem to be a huge reason to have it split out. It appears to be, though, the urban zone was put together, and maybe you can put this, you can clarify this, was put together to maximize the benefits of urban geese late. So would the, so I'm thinking, if the urban zone is a special zone designed for a late season goose zone, I don't see a reason why the northern zone was ever created biologically or really for any reason besides the rest of the state. So my comment is that it doesn't appear to be necessary to split it. I'd like to know why that urban zone would be different, if you could clarify. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. So we created the urban zone about 2 years ago, largely because of the number of urban geese that we had along the Wasatch Front. We've seen through our band return data that approximately 25% of our birds are harvested on the first 2 weeks of October, and then from about the middle of October through about the middle of January, very few birds are being shot. And then towards the end of January, a lot of those birds will start to go out into the marshland again to establish nesting territories and start to breed. And so we've established or tried to push our dates later and later, because the later we can go, the more opportunity we have for those birds coming out, and the more vulnerable they are to being harvested. So that was the reason for creating that urban zone outside of the rest of the state zone, was just specifically to put more pressure on those four urban counties.
And the northern zone is pretty much purely a social issue. Is that correct? Yes.
Yeah, looking at the harvest data specifically for Eastern Boxelder County, harvest is around 40% for the first 2 weeks of October, and then it drops off to anywhere from like 8 to 10% for the rest of the season, from the middle of October all the way through the middle of January when that season has ended.
So, Blair, I just had a question for you. Does the state have any criteria to, I'm trying to think of Becky's concerns and the residents there in Huntsville. Does the state have any criteria at what point an area becomes so urbanized that it becomes to the benefit to close that down for hunting?
There's not a whole lot of real specific examples I could give you on where we've done that. And we've tried to leave hunting opportunity open to every extent possible. There are situations where, you know, you have to be within or more than 600 feet away from a structure, as well as obey, you know, city and county ordinances. But we've tried not to regulate hunting really outside of what city and county ordinances are.
So is it primarily the city and county ordinances, and that pushes hunting out more to the margins?
Yeah, for the most part. Okay.
John.
Blair.
Oh, another John. Go ahead.
Is the situation up there, or is hunting taking place within that 600 feet?
You know, I'm not familiar at all with the situation up there. I don't know if the region has someone that would like to answer that.
Well, I wanted to provide some clarification on Paul's question first, and that is, there's state law that says you're not allowed to hunt within 600 feet of a structure.
Right.
So we always fall back to that as kind of the safety zone.
Sure.
And dealing with Antelope Island Causeway is a road, and so that's kind of a little different in that you're not allowed to shoot from, upon, or across the road. Correct. But as long as you're off the road 2 feet, you can go ahead and hunt. So that was a different situation. To my knowledge, there has been some waterfowl hunting that's occurred closer to closer than 600 feet to some of these homes in Huntsville. We've encouraged the residents to make sure they're contacting our law enforcement officers when that happens, and if we observe it, we will issue citations.
Yeah, I know we've had this discussion last year, and I'm just sensitive to Becky's comments. I mean, growing up, I watched some ducks that had basically became tame ducks in our back area. They were shot during hunting season, so I'm sensitive to that emotional play that puts on people. And yet, I know that our law enforcement officers, both of them, have been up there and looked at these situations and recognize the distance there. So, no, I appreciate that.
Yeah, and maybe this is a question for Justin, but what are we talking about in terms of the numbers of hunters that are using that area of Ogden Valley? I'm familiar with the Hooper area in Ogden Bay, but I don't know what's going on up there in Huntsville.
Yeah, I'm probably not the best to answer that question. Do we have anybody from law enforcement like Dave Beveridge here?
Up to the mic.
And Crystal, this question's directed at what kind of hunter activity occurs around the reservoir.
Unfortunately, I haven't seen anything in that particular area that I've patrolled. Unfortunately, Devin's not present tonight. He'd probably be the best officer, or Dave Beveridge, to provide that information for you.
Okay. State your name, if you would, for the record.
Crystal Tucker, South Davis officer.
Just a general comment, and Becky could correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe there's a lot of waterfowl hunting that occurs up there. There's a handful of guys that probably hunt that opening weekend of the duck and goose season, and then there's a handful of guys that probably hunt when things are frozen, but the inlets coming into Pineview are still open, so they're out on the edge of the flowing water and the open water areas. But that I don't have anything to back that up other than just observations when I drive by the reservoir. But we can get that information. Maybe we can you check with Devin to see if you can get his feeling on that?
Joel? Oh, wait a second. I'm supposed to get sure. Jeffrey, I think. Okay, Joel,
go ahead. Did you want to talk about Pineview? Talk about Pineview while we're on it.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about Northern Goose Zone.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I just want to make a comment on the Pineview request. And boy, I'm sensitive to it too. I grew up around there. I've watched it. I've hunted up there. I've fished. I've water skied. I swam off the tree swing probably near your backyard. And the thing I just want to make a comment on is that it is, we got to keep in mind that this is still public property. It's federal property. And there's a lot of people, and people just spoil everything, it seems. And for the hunters, all the people moving into Huntsville spoiled it. For the people that moved into Huntsville, the hunters are spoiling it. So it's just, you get a lot of people, and I'm sensitive to that. I think I'm going to go with my comment saying that it's not too far different than having a cabin on the edge of the Forest Service land. It's this is yours, but all the rest belongs to everybody, and it belongs to everybody in the United States. This is federal land, and it's really hard to tell people they can't pursue a legal activity. I think you might be better off to pursue a refuge status. That might be a whole other line of thought. But at this point, for my personal comment, I think it's a lot to ask for people to not pursue a legal activity on land that is owned by all of us. We all own it. It's all our land. And I hate to tell anyone they can't do a legal activity that they enjoy. And I do understand that. It's not fun to have somebody shooting a gun at 6 in the morning when you're trying to sleep.
Joel.
Okay. Back to the Northern Goose Zone, a couple of comments I wanted to make. I own and manage several goose and duck clubs in that Corinne area. I talked to some of the club members, spoke to the Chesapeake Duck Club as well as the Bear River Club, which are, pretty good-sized clubs in that area, and they all want the northern goose zone to stay the way it is. But I'm wondering if the success, from what Blair just said, the success ratio is good the first 2 weeks and then it tapers off. So really, overall success shouldn't change by having it one way or the other. Is that correct? I know this is, it's an estimate. And then,
I mean, just kind of basing it off of, I guess, what we see in the rest of the state zone. Or really,
is this
an
urban zone or a rest of the state zone?
Yeah, so the rest of the state zone, I'm looking at the band return data. It's about 25% for the first 2 weeks, and then it really ranges from anywhere from 3 to about 12% between
the
last 2 weeks of October and the first 2 weeks of January.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last week of January, it bumps up again to about 22%.
Oh, does it?
Of
okay.
Total harvest. Yeah.
So here, I guess, a couple of comments or a concern that I have. From a public perspective, right now a person can go on to the Bear River Refuge when the rest of the state is closed and hunt geese. And then he can go on to Farmington Bay late January into February and hunt. If this change were to be made, we'd be cutting 9 days out of the goose hunting season, essentially, for someone that has the ability right now to roam and hunt either area. Correct? So we'd be essentially reducing the ability, I mean, opportunity. Guys have the ability to go and hunt other areas. But this gives them the opportunity to hunt anywhere in the state, or during that. I mean, essentially, we extended the season 2 weeks by doing these split zones. And then the other issue I have, or question, no, not question, comment, is if we, well, I guess ultimately, I think, I mean, me personally, I don't see... the last couple of years have been very open winters, been mild. So there have been geese late, but I can remember years in the past where we've had several feet of snow and there's not a goose to be seen, you know, into January. And so, I don't know. I guarantee there's not going to be, we're not going to be snowpacked that third week of October. But I don't know what's going to happen in January. So that's my opinion on that. So I'm in favor of leaving it the way it is, giving the opportunity the way it is. Oh, the other comment was, the Bear River Refuge, just like they don't open it for the snow goose hunt right now, I can see them not open, because the duck hunt's going to be over. They wouldn't want people out harassing, you know, just their attitude. My assumption would be that they would close it down. When the duck season ends, they're going to be closed as well, to kind of go to your comment, yeah. R. And so, anyway, that's my comment.
Bryce?
By no means am I an expert like Carl is, you know, on the Bear River, you know, because obviously, I mean, they do a lot out there, you know, and what they have benefits what we all hunt. But in the same sense, I mean, I love going to Colorado and Wyoming and hunting, you know, the end of January, February. I mean, you can hunt clear till the 15th of February in Colorado. And for those of us that don't have boats, that don't, you know, go out into the refuge and hunt, you know, it is sure fun hunting the fields, you know, the end of January, first part of February, when the birds finally do come into the fields. So, you know, I don't think it's going to affect obviously what their, you know, percentages are. We kill them the first 2 weeks, you know, the percentage drops to 7 to 10% or whatever. Those, after that, I mean... Yeah, if we get a really cold winter, the birds leave. I mean, yeah, we take a risk of that. But, I mean, what it's trending lately, it's, you know, the birds are usually still here around the end of January. And, you know, there's a pretty good opportunity for a lot of people in Box Elder County that, you know, have fields that get to hunt them, you know. So that it is kind of fun. So, and I do agree with Jeffrey on his comments on Pine View, so.
Let's get Crystal real quick. She has some information for us, and then we'll go back to Jeffrey.
Crystal Tucker. I just spoke with the Weber officer, Devin Christensen, as well as Lieutenant Dave Beveridge. Devin stated that in the last 2014 season, he contacted roughly about for hunters in that area, mostly goose hunters. And he would say that it's a fairly uncommon area to hunt currently. Probably not more than about a dozen people, different people or so during the season. So it's not a very heavily used area at this time.
Thank you. Jeffrey?
Okay, I'm going to make a comment on a different thing, on what Jim brought up about the graph that showed the reduction in hunter numbers and waterfowl in direct opposite of the increased birds. I think Jim is onto something, and I just want to make the comment that when you say you don't know why the loss of hunters is happening, I personally think I know what it is. You used to be able to go and hunt a lot of places. All the places, all the wet fields, the creeks, the ditches, the marshes, they're all underneath subdivisions now. They're gone forever. Then you have state lands. Okay, great. We get to go on state lands. It's been lost almost completely to an invasive species, Phragmites. It crowds everybody onto a few waterfowl management areas. What fun is that? A lot of people don't want to go because it's crowded. Although there's a lot of people, there's even way less places to go. I think if we want to address the loss of hunters and licensed duck stamp purchases in Utah, we really need to address the fact that we have hundreds of thousands of state land acres that have been lost to the opportunity to hunt.
That's true. Jim?
Yeah, I agree with Jeffrey on that. I also believe that in this case, hunter satisfaction surveys might be a little misleading. Nowadays, if you get two ducks, you're happy. In my day, if you got two ducks, it was a pretty bad day. You know, times change and attitudes change, but I absolutely agree that Phragmites and changes in the WMAs and reduction in opportunity is certainly contributing to the decrease in waterfowl hunters.
John Blazer.
I have a couple of comments. The first one is I'm a very strong advocate for multiple use of public lands, and you know, I have a sister that lives underneath the airport, or the flyway for the airplanes coming in and out of the airport, and I couldn't stand to live there, but she's learned to, and I don't know whether her house was there first or the airport was. It doesn't really matter, but when we talk about regulating or keeping people from doing things on property, once we remove them from being able to do that, it's virtually impossible to gain that back. And so whenever we talk about pulling a right away from a parcel of property, we need to be very, very, very careful, because very, very seldom does that ever come back. That opportunity is lost forever. The goose hunt on the northern area, it seems to me like a lot of the rules and regulations in the proclamation, and not just goose hunting, but hunting and trapping and pursuing lions and bears and tigers, oh my, but it's becoming so complicated and so all-encompassing that I think one of the reasons we need to look at why our hunter numbers are down is a lot of people are just, they just don't want to live with all of the complicated rhetoric and regulations that apply no matter what they want to put in, what they want to hunt or what they want to do. I thoroughly believe from the people I've talked to that that's one of the reasons why our hunter numbers are down and wildlife is thriving, is because people are just tired of the hassle of trying to figure out how to get their family out to hunt deer, or try to figure out whether today's the day I can hunt geese here, or whether I've got to wait till, you know, for 3 weeks before I can go on schedule my next goose hunt. So I think the more things we can do to simplify the regulations and the hunt times and standardize, I think the better off we would be.
Thank you, John. I'll make a couple quick comments and then maybe we'll be ready for a motion. So on hunting around Pine View, I'm sure if you make a recommendation and it moves forward to the Wildlife Board, they're going to look at opportunity, if we're restricting opportunity. We haven't had any, we don't have any law enforcement saying that there's a health and safety issue. We might have an issue with people violating the law, but that is the Utah code that they should be following anyway. What the proponents are asking for is actually hunting and trapping in the Ogden Valley. So it's a little bit bigger than just focusing right around Pineview. So you need to consider that also. But if someone makes a motion to that effect, it's what the motion is made, not specifically what the proponents have requested. The other thing on the northern Utah goose zone is, or the northern zone is, it seems that there's some opportunity in some years, and some years there's probably no opportunity at all. So you could standardize those regulations and maybe have some opportunity some years, but obviously other years it's just not going to exist. Any other comments from the council? Now, I needed to make one statement. Kenny, your comment card for this agenda item is too late, so we won't be able to entertain that additional comment from the public. Thank you. Okay. Any more comments and or motions from the board on this agenda? Joel?
I'd like to make a motion that we approve the presentation on from Mr. Stringham on the 2015 to 16 migratory game bird season recommendations as presented.
If I could just change it slightly.
Sure.
Recommend the Wildlife Board approve the waterfowl recommendations for 2015-2016 as presented.
Perfect.
Great. Jim?
Did that include the band-tailed pigeon recommendation?
That's part of the presentation.
You said waterfowl. I want to make sure.
Well.
Oh, it's I said migratory game bird, didn't I?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
It's the migratory, it's the entire presentation, migratory game bird.
Okay.
Presentation.
Is that meets the requirement? Does that cover your presentation if they say migratory game bird presentation?
Yep, that would be fine.
That's what it is. Titled here.
Let me write down the motion very carefully then. Okay. Paul, you have something to say while I'm doing that?
Just a clarification.
Yeah.
This would be as amended by Fish and Wildlife Service to match their requirements.
Correct.
I think that would that's part of the presentation. So, yeah. Is there any other discussion on the motion? Jeffrey.
I think, I hate to clog things up, but I would like to make a motion, an amendment to this motion, at least if that's what it's called, to entertain the proposal by these gentlemen to eliminate the northern zone and incorporate it into the rest of the state.
Okay. That goes contrary to the motion.
Well, he wants to make an amendment to the motion, so it would be contrary. But is there a second?
I second it.
Discussion on the amendment. So the amendment by Jeffrey is to eliminate, if I can state it, to eliminate the northern dark goose season, and then the season would follow the rest of the state season dates.
Yeah.
Okay. If a comment on that. I think that before we make such a big recommendation, I think there needs to be a study period. I mean, if it's something that will truly benefit the goose hunters, I would be in favor of it. But we have no idea what the result's going to be. We have not received any public input. And this is going to impact a lot of goose. I mean, Box Elder County is a big goose hunting area. It's going to impact a lot of hunters. And so to, I guess, kind of paint with a broad brushstroke, where we just received the email from Mr. Dillery 3 days ago. It's kind of a big move in a hurry, and it might be something that would be more appropriate to readdress in our December meeting. I mean, it's coming up again quick, so that my comment on that.
John.
Yeah, I certainly sympathize with the group that wants to change these dates. However, it wasn't proposed in any of the agenda items or whatnot. So those that may be in favor of keeping the dates as they are haven't had a chance to make their opinions known.
Jim?
Well, I think that's what this meeting's for, but the reason that I would go along with the amendment is primarily by what John Blazard said, and that is simplify it. If you want to shoot geese, you can go out and lay on the ice in January. I've done it a few times, and you're gonna be able to hunt geese. So I like to simplify things. Personally, I'd like to have the whole state. I'd like to do it with the urban, just because then if I wake up one morning, I know goose season's open, I can go goose hunting. If I wake up and I know goose season's over, I can't go hunting, but I have to go check the proclamation every time I go. It's the same thing I have to do when I go fishing, get tired of it. So I don't, to me, it's the whole argument is one group of hunters who want it one way and the other group of hunters who want it another way. So I don't really care about that. I'm voting for the amendment simply because I want to simplify the process and make it so that the average guy can say, well, season's over, I'll go do something else, or season's open, I'll go hunting.
Jeffrey.
Along the lines of that simplification, I have to agree. That's the main reason why I think it's a reason to consider. Although simplifications are baby steps, and I am totally understand Joel's idea that, hey, this is quick and it's a big change for a lot of people, and Box Elder County is a big waterfowling zone. However, it's got to start somewhere. And if we want to try to simplify, now's as good a time as any. That's how I feel.
Did you have another comment, Joel, or you got?
I was just going to say, with the kind of increased schedule, we're going to be readdressing this in 6 months, 7 months in December. So that was all.
Any additional discussion on the amendment to the motion? Okay. Are we all clear? Then the amendment would be to eliminate the Dark Goose Northern Zone. Okay, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand. 6-4, opposed? Six opposed.
You get to vote. On your last meeting.
Big decision.
Thanks. I'm geese, yes.
No pressure.
I'm going to vote for the amendment based upon the, I think it'll provide some opportunity. I do expect Blair to be looking at if there is some significant impact that they will address this in the future. And so motion carries 7-4, 6 opposed. Okay, we're good. We don't need applause. So now we're back to the original amended motion. So the original amended motion will be to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the migratory game bird presentation as presented with the amendment of eliminating the Northern Dark Goose Zone. Jody and I will go over the wording specifically after the meeting. Okay, so is everyone clear on that motion? Any additional discussion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand, say aye. 11 in favor, opposed? 1. Joel, would you like to give your reasoning?
Well, I think the reasoning of simplification of the rule book is not a valid argument. I mean, we just split the deer season or the deer units into 37 or something units across the state, and y'all voted for it.
No,
and
no
to have three goose zones, and you think that's complicated? I mean, I think that that's not a valid argument. In addition, I just think making a big decision like this on such a short notice, the public has not been informed. I mean, Jim, you say that that's what this meeting's for. No one knew that that was going to be discussed at this meeting, or there would be a lot more people here, I guarantee it. And so to have such a big decision made on such short notice, I think is a little bit irresponsible for us to do.
Thank you. Jim?
This RAC didn't all vote for the changes in the deer hunt. I can promise you that. But the decision made here is simply a recommendation to the board. So this isn't the final word, and they'll have plenty of time to mobilize their forces by the time the Wildlife Board meets.
All right. We're going to proceed to item number 6, urban deer control. You guys want to take a quick 10-minute break before we get you started? Let's do that. Let's reconvene at 7:45. Go ahead and start, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator out of Salt Lake. And this evening I will be presenting changes to the Urban Deer Control Rule, R657-65. We currently have an Urban Deer Control Rule. It was implemented in 2013 as a pilot program, and it was with Highland City and Bountiful Cities. The purpose of this rule was to evaluate a 2-year pilot program that enabled each of these cities to design and administer a control plan designed for their city specifically, using lethal or non-lethal removal, resident deer damaging private property, and threatening public safety. Our current rule will sunset in August 31st of 2015 this year. So why did we do this pilot program? One of the reasons is because we have a growing population of deer that are taking up residence in our cities and staying there. So we wanted to test the logistical and the economic feasibility of controlling these urban deer populations on a large-scale basis. And we wanted to determine the effectiveness and the cost of various deer control methods and techniques in these urban settings. So I'll go through both cities and how they did it. First would be Highland City. They chose to use a plan using certified volunteer archers, to lethally remove the deer from selected properties within the city limits. It was designed and implemented solely by the city. The results of that is in 2013, they removed 72 deer from Highland City. They logged in 322 volunteer hours and donated to shelters and things. I'm not sure where all the meat went to, but this is from their figures, about 5,500 pounds of meat that year. In 2014, they removed 42 deer and logged 184 volunteer hours. And I just did a little bit of math on that to do some comparisons with the two cities and the two methods that I'll be presenting here. And it was about 4.5 hours per deer to remove them out of the city using this method of the certified volunteer archers. So Bountiful City, on the other hand, chose a non-lethal trap and remove program in cooperation with the division. Bountiful City was responsible for providing the city employees. They implied it in pretty much all winter. They provided a couple of city employees at our disposal for the project. They were responsible for signing up the residents and basically determining where these deer would be removed from and enforcing a no-feeding ordinance that they had enacted. The division was responsible for choosing the appropriate trap method, organizing volunteer efforts. A lot of the the efforts that were done with this was through volunteers. And checking traps and processing the deer and transporting deer to the approved release sites. And the objectives of this with the city were to determine the effectiveness and cost of the translocation of deer from the city. And we wanted to look at public perception, pre- and post-removal, and assess changes in deer vehicle collisions. The results of that, in 2014, we just barely got started on it. This is a little bit of a complicated program to get started at. So we didn't do a whole lot in 2014, just a few weeks worth. But in 2015, we were geared up for it, and 211 deer were translocated. We averaged about 10 to 15 volunteers per day. It's not that that was what was necessary for it, but that's what showed up. There's a lot of people that were more than willing to help with this project. Plus, we had on an average of two division people every day. It took an average of 3 hours per day to process the deer. By processing, I mean just putting on radio collars, giving what shots and disease assessments and things like that. And the average six deer per trap day. And just as a comparison, it took a little bit less hour-wise, but it took about 3.8 hours per deer. And that's not including all the 15 volunteers. That would be just the essential personnel that would have been needed to carry this out. So about 3.8 hours per deer, and that doesn't include the transportation. The preliminary results of this is both methods were effective of removing deer from within the city limits. That was kind of a given. But the non-lethal methods were more costly, time and labor intensive than the lethal removal methods. Survival estimates with non-lethal removal have not yet been determined. We're still in the process of looking at that. And because we still have one more year left to complete the project with Bountiful City. Non-lethal removal is not always an option in some areas. And I would answer any questions on that if you had. So the changes to the current urban deer control rule. First, the purpose of the rule is to enable a city to design and administer a control plan for the lethal or non-lethal removal of year-round resident deer damaging private property or threatening public safety within the city. That's the goal of having this rule here. The changes to the current rule, what we want to do is make this available statewide, make it available to all the cities statewide with a population of greater than 1,000 people. The emphasis is going to be on targeting resident year-round deer. We don't want to target any migratory deer that might come into the city. Require annual reports of lethal removal activities. And the cities must, this is one of the changes to the rules, the cities need to petition the division to include any capture and relocation in their plans, and the division has the sole discretion to authorize or prohibit such activities as part of their plan. Some of the safeguards that we have on this is that the division will specify. This will be probably the division's major role in this, is that we will specify seasonal time periods when the deer can be removed, the total number of deer that may be removed annually, and the number of deer by gender that may be removed. There's an annual report that is required on any non-lethal removal to the division. The capture and live removal has to be agreed upon and authorized by the division. And the division or the city can terminate the plan within 7 days with advance written notice. So the city has to renew the authorization every 3 years and go through the public process so that the city's not going against, contrary to the public, their city's public opinion on this. So that has to be done every 3 years. So basically the process that a city would go through is they would obtain a COR, or a certificate of registration, from the division that would authorize them to plan, to develop a plan with their public input, following all the sideboards that the certificate of registration and our rule have set out for that. And then the city would present the plan for public comment. They would implement the plan, and then they would, after they've implemented the plan, they would provide annual reports to the division, and the city would renew the certificate of registration of their ability to remove these deer from the city every 3 years using the public review process. With that, thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Do we have anyone from the public who'd like to ask a question on the presentation? I don't think she does, so. Questions from the council? Jim.
So, why isn't non-lethal always an option?
Say that again.
You said that non-lethal removal is not always an option, and you said you'd tell us why, and I'm asking you why.
Because non-lethal means that we're going to translocate deer. We're going to take them from the cities and relocate them to another spot. Sometimes we have disease concerns. We have several diseases in the state that we want to be very careful about moving around. And so if a city's within some of these zones that we
Scott?
Have their areas of concern.
Scott, can you kind of move around so you're looking at him but talking into the mic?
Yes. You don't have to look at me.
Please. Okay.
And that's probably one of the main reasons is that if they're in some of these zones that we don't want to risk, or there's a high risk of moving disease around, that it would not be an option for a city.
So lethal is always an option?
Yes. It would always be an option. Yes.
Okay. John Blazer? Or did he cover it?
No. Do you have a lot of other cities that are asking about being able to do this?
Yeah, there's been quite an interest. I think in the northern region, you could help me out, Justin, here, there's six, seven cities that...
Yeah, six to eight cities that have expressed an interest.
Interest in utilizing this. And this would be an optional, but cities don't have to. This is something they would opt into.
So. Do they have to be an incorporated city?
When we did this, we looked at the class of the cities, and I think the reasoning for having the greater than 1,000 was because of the bond requirements or the liability insurance requirements. Probably cities that have less than that would not be able to meet that requirement.
Okay. So how far away do you usually move these deer?
Far enough away that they don't come back. We know that if we move them, you know, just up a canyon or something, that sometimes they may even beat us back. But like the project we did with Bountiful and the deer that we took, some of them went clear out to the Uinta Basin, and some of them went into Box Elder County, far enough away that they can't find their way back. So we don't know the optimum range, but we know that we have to take them far. Quite far away, so they're pretty good homing pigeons.
I just wanted to make the comment that I know
questions.
This is question
questions.
Time,
yeah.
But my question is do you analyze where you're going to dump them off so that they don't become a depredation problem?
Yes,
for
we do.
Farmland.
Yes, we do. What we did is went through last year in our state deer management plans. And went through all of the regions and asked them to identify places that we could translocate deer to. And that was one of the criteria, is look at it, where they aren't going to cause depredation, where we've historically had good deer populations, but for whatever reason there aren't any, or low populations now. And so, but that was one of the criteria, is not to impact agriculture that way.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Craig?
How do you determine that they're resident deer? If they're just maybe coming in the wintertime, or does it have to be there all the time? Or
Channing Howard is one of the people that's been working on this fervently for several years here. She has a method of rolling an apple, and if they chase the apple, it's a resident deer. If they don't, it's probably no. What we have is... So, I had to add that in. What we have is resident... A lot of times you'll have a migration, for example, in November, where the bucks will come down because there are does during the breeding season. They'll come down, and that's things we want to avoid, things like that. But the earlier in the year, you know, when it's acceptable to take those is usually when your resident deer are there. Later as the season, as the weather drives the deer closer down out of the mountains to the city limits, is when we want to try and avoid taking any migratory deer. It's not going to be 100%, but we're going to do everything we can to avoid that just by setting the season times when they can. And it might be different for Logan as for Bountiful. It might be, it's going to be have to be designed for each city to avoid that. But that's one of the emphases we did put in on this rule, is to avoid any migratory deer. We wanted to target the resident deer that are causing the problem.
Chris?
Scott, you gave us some numbers for the first 2 years in both Highland and Bountiful of the number of deer that were taken. What I'm wondering is, based on the take and the estimates of the population size, can we say how much each of the efforts reduced by a percentage the population through each of the methods? Or is there follow-up data gathering to determine the drop in the significance of the damage or the collisions with vehicles, you know, that the deer were causing? I mean, I'm looking for what data is now being gathered to say this is a successful program either way, rather than just we got 114 deer in Highland and we got 247, you know, translocated deer in Bountiful.
That's a really good question. And yes, we are gathering data on this. And we'll start with Highland. It's really hard to estimate a population of deer within city limits. They're just really hard to count, being that they are in people's backyards. So it's hard to get that estimate. And so we looked at social tolerance as one of the measures on this. And part of the project in Bountiful is that we sent out a questionnaire to a random sample of this is all done through the university of residents, and we're probably looking at more of a social tolerance, you know, whether they're noticing a difference. We've already sent it out, and we know what they have said beginning the project, and then at the end of the project we'll send out another questionnaire to assess that social tolerance, you know. But we don't have any way to really measure the percentage of deer that we have taken out. Highland City, for example, they've said that they've noticed a decrease in the number of deer vehicle collisions, and the residents have just talking to them have said that they've noticed a decrease in the number of deer by taking that. So, but we don't have really a hard number to compare it with, because we don't have a way to census deer populations in a city like that.
So, sort of a related question, as you propose the program be expanded to other communities. There's a statement that communities can apply when deer are collectively causing significant damage to private property or threatening public safety. Who decides? Is it the city that says, you know, they're causing significant damage, or there are assessments that the division goes out and does, along with data about collisions and such?
This would come from the cities. The cities, as part of the, well, what happens with the cities is that they usually complain to the city officials, and so they would come to us and say, and this is part of the public process of going through to get this, is that as they present this plan, it has to be presented to the city, and there's a democratic process that has to take place, that they either approve it or don't approve it as removal by the city, so it will originate with the city. It's not something we go out and say there's too many deer in North Logan. North Logan would approach us and say, you know, hey, we need some help with this. And,
okay, so the city gets to make their own assessment, yes, of whether the damage is significant or not.
That's correct, yeah.
Thank you.
Jim.
And there was a public comment requirement, but I'm assuming that public comment is the city's type meeting. That once, if the RAC and board approve this process, we're done, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Any additional questions from the council? We have no blue cards, so we'll go right to RAC comments and our motions.
I move we approve the procedure for urban deer control as presented by the division.
Second.
If I could restate your motion, recommend the Wildlife Board approve the Urban Deer Control R657-65 rule amendments as presented.
Acceptable.
Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
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 It's unanimous. Thank you, Scott. We'll now go to item number 7, election of RAC chair and vice chair. I will make some comments real quick beforehand. So the RAC chair's main responsibility will be to efficiently run the council meeting, hopefully. Of course, that all depends on council members. Then
I'm leaving, so it's not a problem anymore.
You claim you're the sole problem on the council. Okay. After the minutes are transcribed, the next big thing for the RAC chair to do is to go through the minutes for accuracy and formatting. There is a specific format how they're supposed to be delivered. So then the third item is to represent the council at the Wildlife Board meetings. So the vice chair can fill those roles, but they should be prepared. Whoever chairs the meeting should be prepared to attend the Wildlife Board meeting to represent the council's actions in those motions. So if you chair a meeting, you should be able to go to the Wildlife Board meeting for those agenda items, okay? With that, I will turn it over to our regional supervisor, executive secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've never had to conduct one of these elections before, so bear with me. I guess at this point we'd like to get a feeling for if any RAC member has an interest in becoming the new chair. We had.
I am willing if there is no one else that is also willing.
I think you would do a fabulous job.
I hear a train whistle.
Good to know. Thank you.
Did you do it by acclamation? Okay. Or do you want a motion?
So, go ahead, Jim.
Well, I nominate John Cabot as the chair for the next foreseeable future.
I would second that.
2 years.
2 years. That's
all. So, a nomination by Jim and a second by John, or Greg, or was it John? John.
Move that nomination cease.
Second.
So at this point, let's go ahead and vote on the motion. All in favor, raise your hand. Appears to be unanimous.
Yeah. Let me just make one more comment here real quick before you choose your vice chair. You might not be aware, but there'll be five more people cycling through in 2 years. So it would be good for some of you that will still remain on the council, if you're willing to step up and if you're interested, to be the vice chair, and then potentially in 2 years, you could be the chair. At least you'd have some experience, okay?
Could we ask who would be here after 2 years?
Yes. No, but who's on now that'll be there in 2 years? So, Bruce will still be on. Chris will still be on. Where's Bryce? Bryce will still be. John Blazard. John Blazard will still be on the council. Okay, so that's just kind of my comment. It all depends on your personal time available too, if you see yourself filling that role in the future.
I'd like to just ask if somebody's would like to be the chair, kind of like we started out with the chairman, if somebody'd like to be the vice chair.
Bryce.
Yeah, I think we should nominate Bryce Thurgood.
Second.
Make the motion.
Go ahead,
I'd like
motion.
To make a motion to nominate Bryce Thurgood.
I'll second.
Okay, I guess I'll go ahead and call for a vote. All in favor?
Just a question, but all we're doing is voting for the vice chair. There is no requirement nor anything in the rule that says that vice chair becomes the chair in 2 or 4 years.
No, but you have to be able to work the timer.
I withdraw my...
I'll go to training for it.
So you ready for a vote?
I move we close nominations.
Okay, you're one step ahead, so... Okay, with nominations being closed, do we have a vote on the motion? All in favor?
Do we have a second?
Second.
Yeah, we do have a second. Okay. I don't remember who that was. It's okay.
I think it is okay.
So all those in favor, please raise your hand.
He's not going to vote for himself.
Okay, it appears to be unanimous. Welcome aboard. New chair and vice chair.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being willing to serve the council. So your responsibilities will begin at the next meeting, which will be in July.
28th.
July 28th, so, and John will be sending you lots of emails, and I will provide him a little bit of guidance. So, yep, so we're going to go with our last agenda item, WMA Habitat Management Plans.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
thanks. So I'm Pam Kramer with the division in our Ogden office, and so.
You need to talk to the microphone.
I'm sorry.
Just pull it down.
It's bigger
Pam.
Than me.
It's
bigger
than me. Step on the box.
So there's three management plans that we're going to be looking have you look at tonight that I have this presentation for. So a lot of people have asked the question about why you guys are here and having to look at these plans. And so this kind of gives a little bit of an idea of why we're here. So there's the Utah State Code 2321.2.2 provides for the all of our division lands to have a management plan written for them and then that to go through a process. And that process is at first the plan is written within each of the one of the five regions of the division. And then is then reviewed by the Ogden or by the staff within that particular office. Here it was the Ogden office. Then the next thing it does is it goes through the UDWR Habitat Council for review. And if you are you all familiar with the Habitat Council with the division of the public and individuals of the division, and then there's the private individuals are also on the council that then vote for whether projects will proceed or not. So it goes through that process for comments. It then goes through RDCC, which is the Resource Development Coordinating Council, which if you're not familiar with that, that's kind of a governor's clearinghouse for projects that happen within the state of Utah. Originally, it was set up just for projects that happen on public land, like Forest Service logging, BLM grazing, BOR, dam work, et cetera. And now it's come to include a lot more things like division, like our management plans, et cetera. So we go through them to get comments from other state agencies. At the same time, we also do presentations for each of the county commissions for which the plan or the property is actually in. So we get comments from them. And then we come to you guys for approval on the plans. And then state code says the wildlife board is optional. So if the wildlife board chooses to want to hear the plan or provide comment on it, they can do so. But that's kind of the process is laid out in state code. The three plans we're going to look at tonight are Ogden Bay, Waterfall Management Area, Middle Fork Wildlife Management Area, and the Swan Creek Wildlife Management Area. So I'm going to go through each one of the plans separately and then ask for questions on those particular plans so we don't have all the questions at the end for you. So our first one is for Ogden Bay WMA, and I also have Mr. Chad Cranny, who's the assistant superintendent at Ogden Bay. If you have any particular questions on that, he can help me answer those. So for Ogden Bay WMA, it was the first Pittman-Robinson federal aid project in the United States, so back in 1937. It's UDWR's largest waterfowl area at 19,000 acres, more or less. By Utah State Code Section 2321.5, it allows for the management of an additional 10,000 acres of the Great Salt Lake. And so part of that is managed through the Ogden Bay Waterfowl Management Area, as well as Harold Crane has some and Howard Slew, all the different waterfowl management areas that can also manage portions of the Great Salt Lake. Ogden Bay currently has 24 water rights. 21 of those rights are for 19 plus cubic feet per second, and three rights for, that have been given to the BOR for 90 CFS. Most of these are proved up on, but there's not enough water in some areas to create the optimal habitat that we like to do on the marshes. Ogden Bay is also an important wishrun site with over 1 million bird user days with 250 species found using the WMA. And wishrun stands for the Western Hemispheric Shorebird Reserve Network, for those of you who don't aren't into all the acronyms. And it's also been declared an important bird area by the National Audubon Society and the American Bird Conservatory. So this is a map of Ogden Bay for those who may not be familiar with it. The orange is the Ogden Bay fee title lands that the division actually owns. The yellow is the fee title lands of the Howard Slew WMA that we actually own. And all the kind of hashed area is those lands I talked about that we can manage via state code that goes out into the Great Salt Lake. Those are lands that are actually owned and administered by the Division of Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, but the division has the management authority on those for wildlife. Does that kind of make sense for everybody? Our objectives at Ogden Bay are to preserve, restore, and enhance aquatic and terrestrial habitat for wildlife, and management of the area is to maintain a diversified plant community with diversified structural component, to preserve, conserve, and recover sensitive wildlife species and protect cultural resources that are out on the shore of the Great Salt Lake, and provide for recreational opportunities that are compatible for the purpose of the wetland ecosystem. Public access is also managed to reduce disturbance during the critical reproductive period for wildlife that utilize that area for nesting and breeding. So EWP is the emergency watershed project that was done back in 2011. We had all the flooding that was done on the shores of the Great Salt Lake. And so this is just gives you just a quick brief summary of some of the things that were done. That was a fourth $4 billion plus mitigation package that happened on DWR. If you remember, back then they had to breach the dikes on DWR to let or the Ogden Bay to let all the water flow out to the Great Salt Lake. And so as part of that, they had all this mitigation that Weber County and the EWP project put together to make us whole again. So as part of that, in the north run, we've got three new large radial gates. In our middle run, we have two new screw gates, one and one medium-sized radial gate. In the south run, we have three rebuilt radials and three new radial gates. They also did debris removals from over nine miles of channels. We got three new bridges out of that. We had three new radials and screw gates that will now be electronically and remotely controlled, which is kind of nice to be able to do that from an office. And the Unit 1 distribution channel is now in a new location and has elevated 1.25 miles of dike with 70 turnout structures and a four-bay structure also installed within the dike. So we did quite a bit with that. I kind of put this in for a lot of folks who don't really understand what goes on in a WMA. And if you look at, this is just all the infrastructure that has to be maintained. This isn't always how to manage all the marshes. This is just like all the fences have to be maintained, all the parking lots, the dikes and the trails, the gates, the signs, et cetera. There's quite a large variety of stuff that goes on out there that people don't realize that, you know, there's almost 50 miles of fence line that's out on the property that has to be maintained. There's also a lot of buildings and structures with the old office buildings and garages and bunkhouses, et cetera, that's out there. This is our the kind of a same view of the map that you saw earlier, only just shows what our access areas are and help you understand. So the three dog training areas, we have one dog training area here, a little guy right here, and then this one right here. And for reference, this is our headquarters site right in this location right here. And this down here, this yellow, this is the Howard Slough WMA to kind of give you an idea of the size of that. We have numerous parking areas around the property and numerous boat launches as well. So to give you an idea of the public access and the use we have on the property, we estimate over 80,000 visitors a year come and use Ogden Bay Waterfowl Management Area. Of those, 15 to 25,000 are hunter visits, and they take about 20 to 30,000 birds a year off the property. So that means all the other, between the 25,000 and the 80,000, all the rest of those people would be school groups that come out, Great Salt Lake Bird Festival tours that come out, photographers that come out, all kinds of different folks that come out, sightseers, picnickers, that kind of thing, kind of folks. We have non-motorized access year-long, except in the posted closed wildlife production areas. And motorized access, vehicle access is only on the gravel roads and dikes and parking areas during the waterfowl hunting season. There's no parking allowed on dikes and roads. We do have 13 parking lots available for vehicles. And to continue with that, we have small motorized boats are allowed in the river channels and diked impoundments. However, airboats and OHVs are confined to the Great Salt Lake shoreline west of the diked impoundments. Airboat channels and designated OHV trails are available from the Pintail Flats parking lot to the GSL shoreline. And Pintail Flats is one of the parking lots on the very north part of the property, just south of 12th Street, if those are familiar with the Ogden area. And then there are those three dog training areas that are available. So the habitat improvement activities we're proposing for the next 5 to 10 years, which is about how long a plan is good for, is to continually provide at least 1,000 acres of wetlands in high productivity early successional states. To continue the vegetation treatment of Phragmites, which is utilizing a multi-year strategy of herbicides, prescribed burning, grazing, mowing, replanting, flooding, and then seasonal water drawdowns. And I don't know if you've had in the past, if Randy Berger has been here to provide a presentation on how they treat Phragmites, but it's a pretty complicated scenario over a multi-year period. It's not a one-time shot on getting rid of it. But then also to restore and diversify upland habitat through interspersed food and cover plantings, and continued renovation of upland habitats over time as they become filled in. And this might include up to planting 10 to 30 acres a year. Could be include some burning, disking, and then some grazing as well. And then there's always the continual carp control because we carp just love it out there. Additional activities include to renegotiate with Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands for permission for only UDWR personnel to be involved for completing small burns of less than 50 acres. When we want to burn Phragmites is one of the options that we like to do with the control of that. We have to involve Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, and there's a burn plan, a lot of things that go along with that for larger acreages. But because of that and the air quality issues and the Wasatch Front people issues, you're very limited on when you can do that. And so if we can do smaller burns, we can get more accomplished over time. So we're going to try to work on that. We'd also like to acquire, enhance, and expand additional critical wetland and upland habitats when those opportunities arise. There are properties around the perimeter of Ogden Bay WMA that are wetlands that people want to sell to us or we'd like to acquire to provide buffers, or they provide great wildlife habitat. We want to work with them to do that. And then there's been some talk about taking Phragmites and doing some haying of that with conventional farming equipment, which would be great if we could have a market for it. The current property management needs on the property, include some surveys that need to be done for some boundary lines and markers, some fencing. There's always new fencing or repair work that needs to be done on when you have almost 50 miles of fencing. Always new signs that need to be needed on the facilities. There's some new insulation that's needed and some new storage areas, as well as the protection of some of the historic structures. Coming back from 1937, there are still some old buildings that are there to protect. With water control, they're about done with the EWP project, that one I mentioned earlier. I think there's just a couple things, and Chad could probably speak more to that if you had questions on that. Regraveling and sealing of roads, since muskrats love to dig through our roads and dikes. Replacing at least 30 steel headgates. Evaluating the safety of some bridges. And then in the, if you haven't been there recently, Val was working on before he left, the CCC is a Civilian Conservation Corps who helped with the establishment of Ogden Bay in 1937. And Val got to put in some monuments to them right at the entrance of Ogden Bay. And so wants to kind of finish that little parking area that's there. It's kind of a nice addition. So going through the process I talked to you about earlier, we have the UDWR Habitat Council, RDCC, and Weber County. I presented this plan to them. And the only thing that they had asked is that to expand the dog training text to include more information on the existing areas that we have. And that we do not intend to create any additional areas. And so the plan that you guys got a chance to review had that updated text in it, so you should have the complete plan on that. So with that, I'll take any questions on Ogden Bay before we move to the next plan.
Questions on the Ogden Bay presentation? Jim, Reed.
Just a quickie. Uh-huh. That's a lot of infrastructure and a lot of repairs needed. Where are you going to get all the money to do that? Do you have to put yearly requisitions into the legislature, or is it all coming out of your normal budget that you're just stuck with each year?
A lot of our budget comes from Chad, you can probably address it better than I can. He is the assistant manager at Ogden Bay. He can tell you more precisely where the money's come from.
Yeah, so my name's Chad Cranny, the assistant manager out there. Currently, yes, we do need to use our current budget that we are given every year. We also have opportunities through the Habitat Council. We also have opportunities to look at other grants and apply for those. So there is definitely a need to try and build the budget out at Ogden Bay right now. Does that answer your question?
Do you think you're going to get any of that? I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I just see a lot of infrastructure on there. I just was wondering, what do you think the percentages of your... Do you project being able to do any of that stuff in the next coming maybe 5 years?
That's a good question. The percentage of how much that would get done, I am not exactly sure. But yeah, there is some opportunity out there to increase our budget, look for other funding, and try and get some of that stuff done. And some of that stuff will get done.
Chad, what's your budget now for that? Do you know, roundabout?
Currently, the standard operating budget is around $51,000 a year.
That doesn't go very far.
Jim?
Yeah, there used to be, Unit 1 used to be a rest area. Is there any thoughts of bringing that back?
There has been talk about putting a new rest area out at Ogden Bay. Justin, correct me if I'm wrong here. I believe that was actually part of the Great Salt Lake Waterfowl Advisory Committee?
Yeah, that's correct. And historically, Unit 3 was the rest area.
Yeah.
Oh. At Ogden
West
Bay.
Of the house, anyway, yeah. And that was, to me, a really important part of Ogden Bay in the old days, because we had a population of birds there year-round, or all through the season, and we waited for a windy day, and we got out on the west side of it and shot schoonies, and... That really changed when we did away with that rest area.
Yeah, and just to clarify, Chad is right. There was a waterfowl committee established, four years ago that made a recommendation to reestablish a rest area at Ogden Bay, but leave that up to the management area personnel as to where it would be best located.
Any additional questions? Jeffrey.
I just want to clarify that what Justin just said. That was a recommendation that was made by that council, but has never been acted on.
Joel.
Yeah. Quick question. I've spoken to a lot of the ranchers that graze out Ogden Bay, and seen a lot of success with that. It seems to be a pretty successful program to help control the spread of Phragmites. Do you anticipate, as it progresses, to increase that, keep it the same? And what do you see happening out there?
So I will say this. We have liked the success of what we've been seeing with the grazing program at Ogden Bay and some of our other satellite sites. But at this point, with the management maybe changing here very soon, I don't want to speculate on what may happen.
I mean, it's something that's had a positive impact on the area.
Yes, I believe so. We've definitely liked what we've been seeing. I would like to comment that there is also a upcoming Utah State University grazing study actually being implemented this year. So we'd like to get some scientific data, actually see what the benefits are and what possibly the negative effects might be also. Mm-hmm.
Sure. I think it's been a very positive thing to do out in these areas.
Any additional questions?
Could I just...
Yes.
One quick comment. Chad, you're the Phragmites guru, and as waterfowlers, I know a lot of us, we want to tell you, we appreciate all your efforts out there. You're opening up access and opportunity to hunting and creating wildlife habitat. It's awesome. Thank
you. Okay, let's proceed with our next one.
Okay. So our next property we're going to look at tonight is the Middle Fork Wildlife Management Area. So the Middle Fork Wildlife Management Area sits in eastern Weber County. And the orange, reddish kind of colored areas, those are the division lands that are owned by fee title. The grayish or the greenish colors are the Forest Service lands. And this area right here, this is the log conservation easement. We can talk about that later. And then this is another easement, conservation easement, the division holds down below it as well. And so the total of this is about 15,000 acres. And that's Pine View Reservoir. I'm not sure where Becky Wood's house is, but somewhere around Pine View Reservoir. So for the Middle Fork WMA, so it was acquired in 1985 to preserve and protect big game winter range and wintering animals and to reduce deer and elk depredation on surrounding properties. Excuse me. We actually got money to acquire that from the Utah State Legislature. That time they were in the mode of buying land for the public to use, and so that's how we got the property. We went and maintained and enhanced wildlife that's found on the property. We want to provide recreational opportunities that are consistent with and support these wildlife values and that support the intent of the Utah State Legislature in creating the WMA, which was wildlife and was also recreation opportunities. We want to work cooperatively with land management agencies, mainly the Forest Service, and other private landowners to plan and implement projects that will improve wildlife habitat and range conditions in general on and around the property. Improvement projects will focus on sagebrush steppe habitats to provide critical winter ranges for deer and elk populations. Current management is to enhance the big game winter range in the area. We also want to treat the Middle Fork of the Ogden River, which runs through the property, to remove non-native fishes and hopefully restock with native Bonneville cutthroat trout. The surrounding private property also provides critical winter ranges, and so we'd like to permanently protect, conserve, or enhance those where possible to give the animals more of an area to winter in. We also like to implement wildfire protection strategies, such as vegetation enhancements, which might include fuel breaks on the power line road that runs through the property, along our southern boundary and throughout the landscape. As the Powder Mountain, which sits above at the north end of the property, they have a fire plan, and they would like to help us work on doing some fire breaks on our property, because that would stop fires from then proceeding up onto their property. We'd also like to install a fence along our boundary between the Middle Fork property and properties to our west to reduce some of the trespass grazing and secure the property boundary. This is, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, these are two examples of range trends studies that are on, one's on the WMA, the Middle Fork WMA, and the second one is on Gertsen Canyon, which is on the Lobb Conservation Easement, which the division holds. And for those of you who haven't seen these before, the division has one of the oldest range trend transects in the country. And other states look to us with envy because we have a lot of data over multiple years that a lot of other states don't have on their winter ranges. And so this just kind of gives you an idea of what would they look at with the browse component, the grasses and the forbs. And then the winter condition, which is the last row at the bottom, is kind of targeted towards mule deer to look at how well is that property doing just for mule deer, and looking at the different the browse species, the preferred browse species, looking at the shrub recruitment, the shrub decadence, et cetera. And so that's where this property sits right now. This is another picture of the Middle Fork property boundary, showing the access maps. We have a parking area at the bottom, very bottom of the property right here. And then the rest of the property is closed to access, to vehicle access. It's open most of the year for public access. We'll get into that in a minute. This right here, this is the power line that kind of goes through. There's also a little road under the power line. And the rest of these are just small little trails that go through the property. So right now, for our access, the property is, we have it annually closed January 1st to the second Saturday of April to reduce impacts to wintering and being game animals. We want to keep that closed down so that we had problems long ago with animals, because the public came onto the property, the animals would move off into the surrounding private lands and cause agricultural damage and cause us lots of heartache. So we wanted to close that down to keep the animals on us so they didn't depredate on and cause problems elsewhere. We don't allow any public motorized vehicle access on those roads or trails through the property. The camping limit was reduced on the property from the state limit down to 10 days per individual group within a 30-day limit to give more people the opportunity to camp, because we were having people that would camp there all summer and would not allow other folks that wanted to come up and use the property to be able to do so. We also want to work with outdoor recreationists to develop a trailhead and public trail for multiple users. We've been approached about doing that, taking a trail from Middle Fork Trailhead parking lot all the way over to the Powder Mountain Road. We'd also like to post signs on the kiosk requiring large groups to contact us to get a special use permit before they hold events on the property. We also like to evaluate the parking lot and address other various user needs, because a lot of times on opening weekends we have a lot of people that camp there and picnic there and horse trails. You might have 40, 50 vehicles on a holiday weekend that may be on the property. We also need to secure permanent access to the WMA on the existing entrance road or develop a new road immediately to the east of the road. The road we have now is kind of a handshake agreement with the adjacent landowner. It's nothing permanent, so we need to secure that. And we also like to work with the two landowners of the Lob Conservation Easement and reflect the new fee title ownership of the land, which changed hands just a couple years ago. And then also to amend the conservation easement language to more fully protect wildlife interests. The conservation easement was put on the land back in 1985, and it was one of the first easements in the state of Utah. And so right now we have a much more beefed up, stronger conservation easement template that we use. So we're talking about redoing that if we can. Going through the UDW Arbor Habitat Council, RDCC, and Weber County. These are the things they asked us to look at so far, which is to post signs at the northern boundary of the property to prohibit winter access from Powder Mountain folks. That had been an issue, I guess, that we hadn't been aware of before, but other folks have now told us that they're coming in on us on that end. We wanted us to address the clean out of horse trailers in the parking area where we had people that just start shoveling out their horse manure in the middle of our parking lot. Clarify the grazing language on the property to allow for future grazing if needed for vegetation management. And clarify seasonal closure language to provide for late season hunts that may occur on the property. Right now the property is closed down, like I said, January 1st to the second Saturday of April. And if you want to have a late season hunt, we need to clarify that in the plan so that we can allow that to happen. One more, I think, yep. And a couple other things are to clarify the wildlife action plan language that was in the plan. We wanted to add language about possible future public use survey to quantify and qualify the recreational uses of the WMA. We're getting a lot of uses that are by people that are not, by users that are not, are traditional wildlife users. Not necessarily a bad thing, but what do we have? We don't even know how much is going on up there at this point in time. And then to add language that camping may be evaluated in the future for impacts to wildlife and wildlife habitat. And then following this presentation we put together, I visited with Paul Cowley with the Forest Service, who made some recommended changes to the plan to clarify the MOU that we have with the Forest Service to manage Middle Fork Remember at the beginning, we had Forest Service has a lot of parcels within the boundary of the Middle Fork WMA. To clarify some of that language, that we would work with the Forest Service on any activities that occurred that might affect Forest Service land, whether special use permits or camping or closures or anything like that, and also that Forest Service lands are open year-round to access if people can get to them. So any questions on that?
Could you go back to the map of the WMA?
Would you want the one with
the
property?
The ownership. Right, you just went past it.
There you go.
Okay.
So all the green is the Forest Service then. And so, which is mostly higher up, you know, elevations up through here, with our little parking area, when you access the properties down in this area.
So other than the Forest Service parcels on the perimeter, you could still limit access to the three or four interior parcels based on you can't trespass across an infinite corner, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
And this Forest Service agrees that the property is maintained for wintering wildlife, and so they understand why we're closing that down. But.
Yeah,
Paul?
So we ought to clarify that. You know, the Forest Service lands are open to non-motorized access there. They're accessible year-round, but non-motorized, and you're right. Where they are landlocked, whoever landlocks them, and in this case that's the division, basically when they close their access down, that closes those interior parcels down.
That could allow for less disturbance in the interior.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we recognize that. This area in the forest plan is identified as a 3.2W, which is U. So that's a wildlife emphasis for undeveloped lands.
Additional questions on the presentation?
I have one.
John.
I was just noticing the transect study of Forbes of Browse and also the grasses, mm-hmm. and there, obviously there's no grazing on this property. So, are the trend studies just based strictly upon changes in the climate from dry, drought? Wet, or is there something else that's causing the downward trends? It looks like there's more downs than there are ups, is the reason I was asking that. I know if it was grazing, it would be grazing's fault, but being there's no grazing there, I'm just wondering who we're going to blame. How's that?
Grazing is used as a management tool to help us maintain property, so grazing can be good at times as well.
Right,
so
I understand that. But I'm just wondering who you're going to blame for this one.
Well, in this case, I'm not sure that we really know. I know there's been a lot of invasive species that have come in, a lot of cheatgrass and bulbous bluegrass and some other species that kind of come in and can, more annual species that come in and take over and take a lot of the water from a lot of, it makes such a dense mat of vegetation right. That your seeds can't get established in there. The Middle Fork itself has burned several times, and so when it burns and you get the invasion, you know, of all the other right. grasses that come in, and then you get those hot, dry, south-facing slopes, it's very difficult to get something reestablished. We have done some work in the past, and the plan identifies some of those efforts we've done to try to get some things reestablished in there, and it's just a very difficult thing to try to do. I mean, years ago, I took a squadron of hill field up there with bare root seedlings to try to plant a lot of seedlings up there with planting bars, and it's really rocky, and they just thought they could just do all these, you know, thousands of plants and no problem, and they were a bit surprised how difficult it is. So mm-hmm. We have to really look at that in much more depth and evaluate what we want to do with that. So at this point, the plan says we want to do a couple thousand acres we'd like to enhance in there, but how we're exactly going to do that, we don't know at this point in time.
Thank you.
Unless, Scott, you want to say something? Up to you.
Scott, maybe you could also comment on utilization. What kind of utilization are we seeing by game animals?
Great. So I'm Scott Walker, the habitat manager for the Northern Region. John, to address your question on grazing, we don't graze it because of the infrastructure is not there. She mentioned we need the fence. And the results of the range trend is an artifact of the site location for that one trend. Is on a south-facing slope. It's right as you come in. So as for the whole wildlife management area, as you go up in elevation and up the canyon, the range is actually doing much better. But these lower elevation sites, as Pam indicated, did a good job there. It's mostly an artifact of the introduced grasses, both annual and perennial grasses, that have come in and occupied the site and haven't allowed for that sagebrush to restore and kind of rejuvenate and come in with the younger age class and to push out forbs as well. So a little bit of grazing would probably be a good thing in here and probably change that trend a little bit. We just need to get some fences built and some water distributed and those kind of things. The utilization we're seeing, again, on the lower sites as the sagebrush is a little thinner, I haven't done any rings as far as percent utilization, but the browse looks okay. It's not really been pounded. It changes from year to year. And again, it's the lower end of the wildlife management area that has the heavier impacts from the winter range.
So the trends are not because it's being overutilized. It's basically because of the conditions that it's...
Yeah, as the sagebrush just ages and it doesn't allow for those younger plants to come up and kind of replace the older ones.
Regeneration.
Aging. And then overall, over years, 20, 30 years, the trend tends to go down on the health of the shrubs.
Jim?
So what kind of deer and elk numbers are we talking about? And are they on the increase or are they on the decrease? Or do we know? I mean, the idea is to allow for deer and elk to keep them out of the valley and to give them wintering range, and are we meeting that goal or what? Are there like 5 deer or 50 deer? Or
lots.
It's kind of hard to say because with all the development that goes on around us, you still have animals that move down in the winter range, and so the animals will move into the houses, et cetera, to eat. Just outside the Middle Fork, we had a hay barn a number of years ago that somebody didn't care if the animals came in and ate her hay, so they went down and you know, we had, you know, a couple hundred elk on her just eating all the hay out of her hay barn. So they're still there and they move around. Whether we're doing enough good for them, I don't know. On the whole unit, that would be a Darren question to know if this particular property is doing something that beneficial. We are keeping animals on us, so they're not as bad depredating. We had on the Browning Ranch, which is on the west side of us, and we had the Jensen Ranch on the east side of us. They don't have as many issues as they used to have with that. And just to clarify on the Gertsen Canyon, the study that's on the log conservation easement, that property as of a year ago has now been actively grazed, has a new owner that purchased that property, and so they are grazing it now. So these numbers may change, which would be kind of interesting to see from the grazing perspective. So.
Any additional questions?
But I can get back to you on that, Jim, too. I can find out from Darren and get back to you on that.
Well, I you know, that the purpose of the thing was not to have a good grazing place, but to have animals come onto it. So that's what I was wondering if they're actually using it and if it's...
They are, Jim. The I can't tell you the exact numbers. It varies from year to year. This
sure.
year, not as many as 2 years ago or 3 years ago, right?
Well, sure, no.
So it varies from year to year, but I have seen the flight data. For the elk, and all of the locations that are in that area are on the log easement, the Wolf Creek open space in the Middle Fork wildlife management area. As then it wraps around, of course, they're all up the canyon. But the sightings for the elk from the elk flights at that time of the year, most of them were all on the foothills and in the wildlife management area. And if you go up there any given day, you can sit on the corner and glass the hillside and see the elk on the wildlife management area on those open space areas and not in town and down in the foothills. Sometimes in the really hard winters, you know, they're going to come down.
But sure.
Generally, I feel like it's meeting the goal, sure.
Good. Thanks.
Jeffrey?
It's more of a comment. This is an awesome acquisition. I've been dinking around in that area since I was a kid, and it is just wonderful. It's got turkeys, it's got grouse, it's got fish in the creek, it's got deer, it's got elk. I've seen moose up there. it's just awesome. I'm so glad that we got it. I don't know what the winter condition is considered fair now, but back when I was a kid, younger, I took my 1973 Ford Torino so far up that road one time, I can't believe I got it up that far. And I was just trying to get above the diversion and to go fishing. But it was just violated up there. But it's, you know, a couple years ago I was up there hiking and it looked pretty darn good. So if it's in fair condition now, I hesitate to what it was like in the 70s and 80s when I was up there. It was nasty. So this is a great acquisition. I'm just so happy that we do things like this.
Okay, let's move on.
Excuse me. Our next property is the Swan Creek WMA, and this is located on around the eastern shore, excuse me, the western shore of Bear Lake, with straddles the Utah-Idaho line, and the orange is all our property, and the green is the Border Forest Service property to the west of us. The objectives were, well, the background, it was acquired in 1988 to preserve and protect big game winter range in the area. And wintering animals and to reduce big game depredation on surrounding private property, similar to what we had with the Middle Fork property. And then also to maintain in-stream flows and water quality for Bonneville cutthroat trout that come as the send Swan Creek from Bear Lake to Swan. Our management right now is to work cooperatively with surrounding land management agencies and private landowners to plan and implement projects that will improve wildlife habitat and range conditions in general. And then due to the presence of the Bear Lake Bonneville cutthroat trout, that we're recommending several actions at this time. We want to evaluate the Swan Creek Canal to determine if there is a significant fish loss through the canal, and if so, develop recommendations to reduce that loss, and continue the annual seasonal fishing closure of April 15th to the second Saturday in July to maintain the catch and release regulations on the property, or in the stream. The Swan Creek range trend study, similar to the other one, this is the study for this particular one that's located on Swan Creek WMA. So we still have some issues with the winter conditions for big game, even though some of the other conditions are stable. The Swan Creek WMA, this is the road access map. These roads are all open to vehicle access and public access year-round, but we don't have much issue for them in the wintertime with snowmobiles. The access issues, like I just mentioned, they're open year-round, but snow depth kind of precludes a lot of trespass at this time. The Rich County Commission at one point in time had asked us to consider closing the property during the winter if snowmobiles became a problem or trespass became a problem, but it hasn't been a problem to date at this time. The suggested changes from the Habitat Council, the RDCC, and the Rich County Commission were to clarify and explain the fish screen proposal that we had for the irrigation ditch, the Swan Creek Canal. Add language regarding a collaboration with the Rich County Commission and the Bear Lake Regional Commission to develop seasonal public hiking and biking trails on the WMA, and to identify the property boundary better with signs and evaluate property boundary fencing needs as we may need. And those changes are all reflected in your what you have today, the plan that you reviewed. So short and sweet, smaller property than the others. But
questions? Jim.
So what is the status of that screen, the irrigation ditch screen?
The status of the screen, right now we're going to evaluate if we're actually having the fish loss that's going to occur.
Haven't started building it yet?
No. We know that there are some fish loss that the fish are being taken into the canal and taken on the irrigation fields, you know, downstream. We don't know what the magnitude of that is at this point in time, and so the guys thought before we move forward on putting a full proposal together on what we want to do as a screen to exclude fish, we want to see if it's really a problem. I haven't seen the ditch, but what I've been told is that it's be difficult to kind of put something together. It costs a lot of money, so we want to make sure there's an issue before we move forward on that.
Okay. Yeah, because we were talking about that when I was on the Habitat Council. I just wondered if anything had happened.
Okay.
Apparently not.
Okay, yeah. And I have Paul Thompson here from our aquatic sections here if you have any particular questions on the fish perspective. So I wasn't aware that it had come before the Habitat Council before.
Well, I don't think it came as a proposal for money, just something that was talked about when we were talking about Swan Creek and some improvements there. So
okay.
On the water rights in the table, it looks like the division holds almost 30 cubic feet per second of, you know, older priority, so their water would come first. Is that all in stream? It goes all the way to the lake, or is some of that being diverted lower in this area where you're talking about the fish screen into a canal and then used by other people?
I have to remember, look back at the plan to know for sure, because I have three plans like that, to know for sure. Does it say that those are division water rights?
If yes, they,
are, they
do.
If they are, then they're all in-stream flow rights.
And so then they flow all the way. They guarantee water in Swan Creek clear to the lake.
Right.
Okay.
Unless I misunderstand something, Paul, but I'm pretty sure that's correct on that point. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Any additional questions? I think we're done.
If you haven't seen Swan Creek, it's kind of fun to go to the spring. Have you ever been to Swan Creek to see the water come out of the spring out of the hillside? It's pretty impressive when it comes out. There's quite a bit of water that flows from there. So I guess you guys just need to approve these, and then we can move forward.
It's actually informational. So
okay.
I believe it's policy.
Okay.
Yeah, it's policy. We're supposed to review them, but it's a policy issue for the division. So.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you, everyone, for being here tonight, and thank you for being a very agreeable bunch on the council while I've been the chair. So with that, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn. Oh, and then immediately afterwards, we will have a little presentation from the regional supervisor. Come on over. So
move to adjourn.
Second it.
I'd just like to thank all those who've been on the council or are leaving. It's a pretty good sacrifice to do this. Hope you have enjoyable spare time now.